Hi there, and welcome to A Different Way of Seeing. Have you ever wondered how a disabled person lives their life? Join our host, Lo Strachan, as she chats to people about work, education, travel, sport, the arts and leisure, and the tools and techniques they use to live their lives with the disability. And now, on with the show.
Hi, it's Lois. Just a quick note to say that if you're a person with a disability who is wanting to achieve a goal and would like some help with that, then stay tuned after today's interview and I'll try and help you in that area. Right, let's dive into today's episode. Hi there, and welcome to today's episode of A Different Way of Seeing, a podcast where we talk all things disability. I'm your host, Lois Strachan, and today I am joined for this episode in the Job Talk series of interviews about people doing work with disabilities who work in mainstream jobs. And today, I am so excited to bring this interview to you. I'm talking with Lionel Smith, who I suspect is actually Dr. Lionel Smith. And Lionel is now retired, but he did work for many years as an anaesthetist and then moved into academia. So we have plenty of topics to dive into. Lionel, thank you so much for joining us on A Different Way of Seeing.
Thank you very much for the interview. I've also been looking forward to it.
So I think the best place for us to start is to just ask you to give us a kind of a snapshot of your life and your story.
Okie dokes. I am going to turn 78 in 2 weeks' time. I'm one of six children born to my father, Gordon, who was a schoolmaster, and my mum, Joyce, who was a nursing sister. None of us have a history of retinitis pigmentosa, so I'm isolated. I went through school and high school, university, medical school. I worked in various hospitals. I learned a lot. Mm-hmm. Being a doctor when I was at a mission hospital in KZN, came back, was a general practitioner in Port Elizabeth for 5 years, and then made the decision to specialize as an anaesthetist. I worked in Durban at the academic hospital and worked at Groote Schuur at the academic hospitals and actually worked as a specialist consultant in the anaesthetic department and then came back to Port Elizabeth and worked in a state hospital for 9 months but got very frustrated. Went into private practice for 20 years. Mm-hmm. Always enjoyed teaching, so I retained a link with the state hospital in Port Elizabeth called Livingston, where I taught the junior anaesthetists and prepared them for an exam called the Diploma in Anaesthetics. One evening, my ophthalmologist asked me to give him a lift somewhere, and we drove, and he went silent. When I dropped him at his destination, he said to me, I think you must come and see me in my rooms tomorrow. Okay. I went and he said, look, man, you are not seeing certain things. I was very scared and I was worried when you were driving me. I used to do his operating list, so I used to see him once a week, so he knew what I was capable of.
Yeah.
And I went, and that is when the diagnosis was made. It was a long process getting a definite diagnosis because of my age. I think at that stage I was about almost 60.
It's unusual. Yes.
Yeah, it's unusual. They took retinograms and sent me to Groteskier and Red Cross Children's Hospital, putting little electrodes on my eyes and stimulating it. And they couldn't make a definitive diagnosis. And they said, well, was the testing you doing? Your tests, you shouldn't be able to see. So I said, come in front of me here. I'll punch you in the face. No, we believe. But when my ophthalmologist got an OTP, he could then make the definitive diagnosis. He'd sent all my retinograms to all the retinal congresses in the world, and nobody could put a label on me. Finally, the diagnosis was established that I do have retinitis pigmentosa. It's an aberrant form because of my age, the fact that I could still see a little bit. And I then realized that I couldn't be an anesthetist anymore and was prepared to, I had to stop working, being the sole anesthetist. And then one of the consultants that I'd worked with at Groteskier was now working at the State Hospital in Port Elizabeth and said, hey man, why don't you come and work in the hospital? The junior doctors can be your eyes. We'll never let you give an anesthetic alone.
Yeah.
A lot to give. You enjoy teaching. And I said, maybe just have a break for a month and get my head sorted out. And then I went. And I could still see a fair bit at that stage. But I'd always work with somebody and I'd be teaching and I'd give lectures, formal lectures and then informal teaching in the theater. I would lecture to the nurses in anesthetics who were doing their operating nurse courses.
Yeah.
And I attended congresses because I could still see and help myself a little bit. And then we formalized a lot of the teaching because I was there and because the professor who invited me was also there, and we were doing a full range of operative procedures, from delivering babies in maternity, pediatric babies who needed operations, general surgery, bowel cancers, and hearts and lungs and livers, the whole gambit. And then I was offered the job to run the program where we train specialists in Port Elizabeth, by which time I couldn't read anymore. I couldn't see things on the computer anymore. And my employees over the university at Walter Sisulu Medical School in Mthatha, go and have an interview, and they were happy to take me. And that is what I did until I retired 2.5 years ago, supervising the training of specialists in different disciplines. So we trained I'll give you a few examples, trained specialist psychiatrists, obstetricians, pediatric surgeons, pediatric cardiologists, pediatric cancer doctors, plastic surgery, the full gamut. And
yeah,
I had the support staff of a research assistant, a secretary that I shared with the health department, and I had also supervised a training center, what we call the resource center, that had a manager, it had an events coordinator, and an admin assistant. So I would just get dropped off at work. I could walk from where I was dropped off into my job. I had enough sight for that. And That is what I did, what I enjoyed. I felt useful. I felt that I was an inspiration to young people. I had opened door policy, and I could still recognize faces at that time. And I could attend meetings in Mthatha. I would fly from PE to East London. It's the same air hostess, morning and afternoon, every day. And she would say, here comes my favorite patient. I said, I bet you say that to everybody. She would, you know, put me in my seat, make me comfortable, and so on. Yeah. I used to get the lift then from East London to Mthatha, attend meetings. And when the person giving me a lift retired, yeah, I then had to fly from Port Elizabeth to Johannesburg, and then Johannesburg down to Mthatha.
Oh, my word.
Yes. All with this limited sight. But, of course, I would just say I'm a walk assist.
Yes. Yes.
And
yeah.
I said, do you need a wheelchair? I said, no, I don't need a wheelchair. And off I would go. Quite happy to fly, attend the meetings. And then one of the joys in my life was to get a bursary from Discovery, this Discovery Foundation, the insurance that they were talking about, no medical scheme. And they gave me a lot of money to visit rural hospitals and teach the doctors. Because we were having lots of problems with mums having to have cesarean sections, and the doctors weren't properly trained to do that. And there were tragedies with mums and babies losing their lives. Mm. And I initially became aware of it because I was asked to review these cases just from a statistical point of view. And then we said, no, it's no good. We're just collecting the statistics. We must try and remedy the situation.
Yeah.
So initially, the health department had a budget for doing what we call outreach.
Yes.
And I worked with a wonderful woman. I'm not going to mention her name, but she was dynamic and loud and bustling and didn't stand any nonsense. And the nickname was Tsunami. So I worked with Tsunami, who took me to the different hospitals. Mm-hmm. Took me to different hospitals. Mm-hmm. So I could visit every single hospital in the Eastern Cape.
Goodness.
Rural hospital, with the exception of three. I'm going to leave it at that now. I've given up on those three because of my eyes. So I got wonderful insight into what difficulties young doctors have, yes, rural doctors have, because they have this big load. They're expected to do things that they haven't been trained for. And so it started with initial visits to hospitals with Tsunami. Mm-hmm. She eventually ended up calling me to Tsunami. I said, hey, Tsunami, where are we going? Tsunami, you know we're going to Lady Grey Hospital. Why do you ask? And then, again, I realized that to visit a hospital once a month is not good enough. And I said, man, can't we bring these doctors to Port Elizabeth for 2 weeks? And they can work in the obstetric theatre.
Yes.
At the hospital where we do obstetrics, they do about 15 seizures a day. Because
I can imagine, yeah.
All the difficult cases get sent there, you see. Mm-hmm. So I went along. So the first thing was accommodation. And I went to see the medical superintendent. And he said, yeah, I've got accommodation for you. Okay, where? He says, no, man. You know, in the old days, we had accommodation along racial lines. So there's now the old white doctor's quarters standing empty. you know, beds and fridges and things. And I said, you're really good. He said, yeah, we went. It's right on the premises. Mm-hmm. And some furniture. So I said, okay, good. Now what do we do? We wrote to all the hospitals. We said, we're offering this training. We'll offer you accommodation. At the old Livingston Hospital, they still had the cleaning being done by the hospital staff. So all you got to do is just come, and you can walk to the labor wards, and we'll give you some introductory lectures and a little test before and after. And then let's see how it goes. Of course, the hospital quarters where they didn't have any knives and forks and toasters. And yeah. So I just said, well, how do we get around this? I took R1,000 of my money and we bought knives and forks and toasters and clock radios so that nobody could say we slept late. And then said to the doctor, listen, we're going to stay here for nothing. But we need to buy some equipment here. Mm. So can I charge you R200 each time somebody comes so that we can build up more and more things, like television and things like that for later on? Oh, no, can the hospital pay? I said, man, you need to get R200 out of a rural hospital budget. It sounds like nothing, but it's
24. It's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. Long process. Okay. So that's how we started. And it soon became very popular. And then they moved the obstetric unit to Doring Ginza. And I went to the same person again who gave me the house. I said, hey, now I'm Doring Ginza. Because he said, no, man, just take one of the doctor's houses. So that's what was arranged. We had a 3-bedroom house with kitchen and living room, dining room, bathrooms and things. And that's where the doctors were housed. And the program, it would run on a rotation basis. It was booked full all the time. So, and it really made a difference because with our training, at the same time, the curriculum for the interns changed, and they spent 2 months in the anesthetic department. Mm-hmm. So then we were teaching people who initially had some training, and then it really took off. And so we could then offer ladies in rural hospitals some sort of assurance that the doctor was doing the anesthetic, had some training that was reinforced by us, and we would also check up on our monthly visits. And then, of course, with a 2-year obstetric, 2-year course for interns, 4 months was in obstetric school, so most of the doctors could do a cesarean section.
Yes.
So that is one of the things I take pride in. The other is that I would meet people in hospital visits, and they say, can we come and train for our anesthetic specialist degree in Port Elizabeth? I said, of course you can. Fill in the forms.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you, about half an hour ago, I had a call from the head of the anesthetic department.
Yes.
Oh, Lionel, I just want to tell you that your old anesthetic department has just produced another 3 specialist anesthetists that passed exams.
Oh, congratulations.
One of whom is Dr. T. I'm going to leave it at that.
Yes.
And I went to work at my teaching. I went visit Craddock Hospital on a monthly basis, and he was very interested in anesthetics, so I'd let him do it. With my limited vision, I could check up. Yes, he's doing the right thing.
Yeah.
Today, from that small hospital in Craddock, he is now a specialist anesthetist. And with the previous exams, somebody that I also met at Port Alfred Hospital, interested in anesthetics, has come to Port Elizabeth. He's now a qualified anesthetist as well, as are two other ladies that I met in a rural hospital in Mthatha. And for me, it was, I think, it's such a nice story that so-and-so was born in a small village in rural Eastern Cape, and she's now giving anesthetics for people having open heart operations, major brain surgery. Yeah, and you feel proud.
Mm-hmm.
That would be part of that, and that you don't need sight to do that.
Yes.
Now, if I see them, they say, "Hello, Prof." I say, "Hello. Tell me who you are," you see. And because I can't see faces anymore.
Yes.
So I could be part of that big transition. Yeah.
That is such a wonderful legacy to have left to the world.
Yeah.
And I want to commend you for all that amazing work that you have done. Gosh. But I want to take us right back to that diagnosis.
Mm.
Would you be willing to let me know a bit about how you felt on receiving the diagnosis? And the implications of what you actually realized that it meant in terms of what you were and were not able to see at the time.
You know, it with a slow onset,
mm-hmm.
and I'd had over 50 years of sight.
Yeah.
And I was a family joke because I was night blind. And I would take comfort in the fact that 10% of people are night blind.
Yes.
So I said, yes, that is it. And I'm driving a car. I can recognize my children, kiss and cuddle them and do what everybody else does. And when I started losing my sight, you know, you just say, well, I can still see. I don't get up in the morning and say, hey, thank goodness I can still see. I say, What's for today? This has got to be done. That has got to be done. And when I went for the test, as I said, initially it was putting electrodes on your eyelids and shining, very uncomfortable, and shining lights and seeing what the wave patterns were. They couldn't believe it. They said, oh man, you shouldn't be able to see with this. So they didn't believe the instrumentation. They sent me to Red Cross Children's Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
There was this 50-year-old kid where I'd been a specialist as a doctor, also having these electrodes on the eyelids. And I said, oh, can't be too nice for a kiddie. But anyway, still not happy. They sent me to somebody in Bloubergstrand who had his own private testing things. That still no results. In the meantime, I was, you know, taking my walks, swimming, doing all the things that normal people do. I could still read, and which I enjoyed doing. And I, as I said, probably because it was of such slow onset and because I could still see and work without putting patients in danger, I didn't think too much about it or what the future was going to be. And when the time came that I couldn't work on my own, I had the escape valve of having to teach others.
Yes.
And I could still drive to the hospital every day, but it soon became apparent that I was a danger. So then I got lifts with my sister in the morning, which they dropped me off on our way to my husband's factory where she worked. And in the afternoon, I'd either get a lift with them or my wife would fetch me, or when I gave four lectures. One of the doctors would drop me off at home. But I never really worried about it too much. I went for some low vision training with a wonderful lady. And then also you learn to kick keys and pick them up and feel where you're going. And if you want to change direction with you, put your hands this way or that. I've forgotten which one it is. But when she said to me, now next week, we're going to teach you to walk in the road with a white stick. And up to now, next week hasn't arrived because I have a sort of psychological block. So my attitude, I think, was healthy. I had too much to do other than with seeing things. I transitioned from reading books to audible books. So I can still read and travel via my books. I have an Alexa. I can order audible books, but I have access to other libraries now. Yeah. And it's quite fun choosing books with my wife and my son, and who's now living with us, mm-hmm. and my daughter who's in Australia. Nice. Got a master's degree in English, so I get a wide source of books, audible books that I can read. And I have a wonderful friend in Cape Town where he swap books. And so with regard to my attitudes, do I miss anything? I'd like to see what people are talking about on the television. I'd like to, cricket is one of my passions, so I'd like to see what was going on. If I sit a certain distance from the TV, I can see, but it's the commentary is better with a little bit of vision, but I've said, look, that's not going to happen. So I'd listen to the rugby, and I'll listen to cricket, and I listen to the news. And not too much these days because it's so depressing.
Yeah.
But I enjoy the Afrikaans radio with the stories and interesting topics and travel and music. My taste in music vary from Mozart, Bach, Tchaikovsky to modern pop. Just don't like... what is this? Rapping. I can't relate to that. I listen sometimes and the words are interesting, but if I had a choice, I wouldn't listen to that. And with that, my Alexa enables me, and my phone enables me to get whatever music I require on Spotify. So I think I'm going in the right direction with regard to my attitude towards my sight that's declining. You are an inspiration for me, but I also met a man on the flight between Johannesburg and Mthatha.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a director of the Blind Association for the whole of the Eastern Cape, and he was totally blind.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got a program, I believe, it's called JAWS. And so he said, oh, I do everything in this program, and I can do graphs, and I can write letters. And, well, good, there's hope for me.
Yeah.
And so there you are. And the other inspiration for me is that I've joined a low visibility group in one of the townships where about 12, I'm getting more. We have about four or five people who are totally blind.
Yeah.
You know, they participate and we chat about various things. And one fellow he's got a piano, one of these electronic pianos. Mm-hmm. So one day we went to fetch him in his electronic piano, and for that Thursday we played music and we were singing, and then two blind people started dancing with each other.
Happens.
And I said, "Yo," and he said he'd been to the school for the blind in Belleville as a schoolboy, and he didn't want to take music lessons. He thought he could teach himself. He regrets it now, but he says, "You just sing any tune. I enjoy singing." And then he would pick up, and we had a wonderful time playing. So for me, that is interesting, because two of them used to work in a company that fixed wicker chairs and things.
Yeah.
Yep. And I said, "I've got a chair. I've got a peacock chair." He said, "No, come and fetch me." He came. And brought him and put the chair there and felt him. "Oh, no," he said, "this is an elementary problem. Just get the stuff, small pieces of stuff that is rattan and some small nails, and I'll fix this." I said, "Without you seeing it?" "Yeah, no, not a problem, you see." So that, for me, is, I'm not saying, is that waiting for me? I said, if he can do it, then I can. That's my attitude. Yeah,
I think the important part is to realize that if we master the tools and techniques that are available, there's so little that we actually can't do anymore. And to understand that, and to, I guess, have the courage to try things that may initially seem to be difficult, can be, you know, then, I mean, I'm not always the first person to adopt new technologies, but I do find that if a technology serves a purpose in my life, and if there's a use for it, then I will willingly embrace it and just start exploring it. And suddenly I find that something I couldn't do last week, I can do. And the more we do things, the more familiar it gets and the more second nature it becomes. So, but yeah, it really, and there are many people out there in the world who are doing some incredible work and doing some incredible things. I mean, I have a close friend who is a woodworker.
Okay.
And he is quite comfortable using all these electric saws and things like that. And, you know, there's no reason why not, with the right training and the right, I suppose, the right cautions. But that is a good attitude, because it often takes people a very long time to reach the point that they say, "I'm willing to explore that." And having that curiosity about, is this possible for me, is, I think, is fundamentally important. And, you know, just from the story that you shared with us, knowing that you have a knack and a skill for finding solutions to problems, that will serve you in very good stead as if your eyes continue to deteriorate or to weaken in any way. But I'm quite curious to just, if I'm correct with retinitis pigmentosa, more often than not, people are diagnosed in their teens or in their early 20s. And the progression from there is, I suppose, individual, because it depends on how each person's journey is unique. So the fact that your diagnosis only occurred in your 60s, Is that why it was so difficult to receive a diagnosis, because it was so contrary to the normal pathway of someone living with retinitis pigmentosa?
No. When I went to visit the ophthalmologist, initially said, there's something wrong, you see. Then he went through all the various tests they do, your peripheral vision, yeah, and look into your eyes and all that. So they said, well, from what we see and what you tell us, this fits in with retinitis pigmentosa. Mm. What worries us is that it's happening at your age. So we want to confirm this. So as I said, off I went to Greater Scare in Cape Town.
Oh.
Had the electrodes on my eyes, and then when I said, but you shouldn't be able to see with what I see on you. I said, well, as I said, later to you, I said, I bet you I can punch you in the nose. You said. Then again, it was, you know, speculating. I would say, what could cause it? And he said, well, yeah, it could be a virus. We don't know. As I said, all my pickies were presented at
congresses.
And one particular person from, he's got a practice in Harley Street, was very interested. And every time he saw my wonderful ophthalmologist, he would say, now, how's that? And he said, what are you doing? As I said, it puzzled everybody. And then when they got this OTP thing, they sat me up and looked at me. Oh, now we know. No vietons. But vietons. No, it is an aberrant retinitis pigmentosa, probably caused by a virus. You might not even be aware that you had this infection, and it displays a particular pattern inside your eye. And the problem is that the little cells that transmit vision lie on a foundation. It's probably the easiest way to explain to a layperson. And what has happened is that your foundation, instead of being nice and smooth and regular, is all distorted and pointing the rods and the cones in different directions. And this is why you can still see, and why you form images slowly, and why you are lucky that you can still see a little bit at age 77. So I'm grateful for that. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that puzzled them was that I have very good peripheral vision.
Yes.
Poor central vision, which again doesn't fit the mold. And I said, well, I'm proud not to fit the mold. I don't want to be like everybody else. So there you are.
Gosh.
And then my ophthalmologist retired, and he said, well, here's your file.
Yeah.
And I knew that this is short of an eye transplant. This is it, and this is what is going to be my lot for the rest of my life, and I must just do the best of it. I've got very good hearing, mm-hmm, and tactile sense.
Yeah.
And I can tell who's coming down the passage, if it's my wife or my son. And smell, very good. And pretty great. One big one. I used to be an expert curry cook. Now I can't read the recipes anymore. I can't take out half a teaspoon of turmeric. And I said, it's fine. I've got a library of about 60 curry books. I took out all the favorites, tried and tested, and I have them. have them on computer, and I can send them to people who are interested in careers and get feedback and so on. But I miss not able to actually do the cooking. I've been taught. My son has been a blessing. He looks up all sorts of tricks that one can use during cooking now to slice onions and potatoes and so on. So I offered to help, but he said, "Oh, man, you take too long. Come on." And I just enjoy the meal. So that's, as I said, that's one part that I really miss. And but I can put in an order, and my wife or my son will cook that in the next 3 days. You know.
Well, I can tell you that I cook. I'm not allowed to cook curry at home because I make curries too hot, and so that I can eat them, but my husband can't. But okay. There is no reason why, first, that you won't be able to access your recipes with the right assistive technologies, and that you won't be able to cook, because that is also something that is very possible. I cook all the time. So, you know, we need to chat offline and after the call, and, you know, let me see how I can help to give you little insights into some of the tools and techniques that I'm using, because we can get you making your curries again without any problems. So if you have the courage to try.
You haven't asked me if I want to. I said,
if you are interested. You said it's a regret. So
yeah. You know, there are disadvantages to have low vision. What's that? I said, I don't have to wash the car. I don't have to do the dishes. Yeah, but as I said, I lead a almost full life. Mm-hmm. I've got support of brothers and sisters, and my wife has been wonderful. And son who's come back from Canada, he's been with us the whole year. He's also been very caring and assisting and so on. Mm-hmm. So there we are.
Great. Well, thank you for sharing your life's journey with us. I just want to check through my notes and see if there's anything that we haven't really contacted. I think one of the things that I am curious about is, you mentioned that while you were working and in the work that you're doing, that there were accommodations and people who were able to support and assist you, that you had a team who were able to service transport for you, provide you with transport and to assist with things like that. But what were there other accommodations around the materials and around the process that you needed to make in order to do the work that you did?
As I said to you, that I'd always had an interest in teaching anesthetics, and I did that even when I was in private practice teaching the doctors. And when I went back from private practice full-time to work as a hospital specialist, I had eyes. And then the junior doctors that were put in with me, they were the expert eyes. Mm. And the hospital, the Eastern Cape Department of Health, had a program where they would support specialists from the cities going into the rural areas. Mm. So I would either get the hospital transport and take one of the junior doctors with me, and we would visit the little hospitals, or we'd meet up with the tsunami, and she would drive us to where we had to be. And when I got, as I said, about almost 2 million rand from Discovery to support rural hospitals, then it, you know, you didn't have to have the variable or worry about funding or if your accommodation at the B&B was going to be paid. There was a mechanism that I would pay for everything up front and fill out a report and get the money refunded. Does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you. Because it's just such an interesting thought. And I, for me, it's very inspiring to know that a person who is visually impaired is able to work such a meaningful position in the medical profession, because I think the medical profession particularly is one that is seen as being so high above many people's capabilities. And it just highlights the fact that disability and intellect and ability are often totally divorced. And that for me is such an important thing to be able to underline to my listeners, both those with disabilities and those without. So thank you for sharing a little more of the mechanics there. Lionel, if people would like to reach out to you to connect with you and to follow a little more about you, or just to find out more about you, how can they do so?
The simplest is to call me on my cell phone, which is, I'll give you the number.
As long as you're comfortable sharing the number in a public forum.
Yes, you did to me. Just one warning is that my phone is set up because I can't find the answer switch. So my phone will ring 8 times and then I can speak to whoever it is. But if I'm not in the room or I'm in the shower, then after 8 rings, the person at the other end says, hello.
So that will answer anyway. So your phone has an automatic answer function. Okay. Noted. And if you don't, if there is nobody else on the other side of the line, when they phone, it doesn't mean that you're just not wanting to talk to them. It just means that you were busy with something else. Okay. So noted. Thank you. So if
I can't even switch off the people that I don't want to talk to. I would find that button first, and then secondly, my phone will say if you are in my contacts, it will say who's speaking. Otherwise, it's an unknown number. But I answer unknown numbers. It's usually people trying to sell me something. Who you are, then it's fine. I'm at peace with that.
Okay, then if you feel comfortable sharing your number, please go ahead and do so. And I will also add it into the show notes that come with this episode.
I know of one other doctor who had retinitis pigmentosa. There's a syndrome where you get retinitis pigmentosa and deafness. Can you imagine that?
I think, again, there are techniques, but I think it is very challenging to to be losing two different senses.
There you are.
So do you want to give me the number there?
Yes, 083-459-1760.
And that's on the country code plus 27 for those people outside of South Africa. So as a final question then, what advice would you give to someone who's just received a diagnosis of a visual impairment? Where should they start?
Oh, it'll take me a week.
One piece of advice.
I would say that in the modern world we live in, there are techniques and there are electronic aids to assist, and that the vast majority, this is the most important thing, the vast majority of people are kind and want to help. So I go down to the local mall and I just stop the first person and say, excuse me, I don't see very well. Can you help me cross the road? Oh, certainly, uncle. Come. And they grab me by my arm. Hold on. I've heard the car already. Hold on. I don't know what's going to happen when we have electric motors because they have.
Oh, yes.
And they take me across the road. You know? Or, as I said, the vast majority of people, nobody's been nasty to me. So reflect on what your doctors told you and explore the possibilities in terms of electronics and people assist people to with disabilities, and don't run away if they offer to teach you how to walk with a white stick, and just accept that there's millions and millions of kind people who, if you explain your dilemma, will respond in a kind way.
Lionel Smith, thank you so much for joining us on A Different Way of Seeing. I've so enjoyed the conversation and learning a little of the incredible impact that you've made on the world. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Hi, it's Lois again. I'm not certain if you know, but I am a coach who works specifically with people with disabilities. If you have a disability and are wanting to achieve your goals, or maybe think through some of the challenges that you're facing in your professional or personal life, or want to take up a new opportunity, a new adventure, but just don't seem to be able to get to doing it, let's explore how I can help you. Hop on to the Contact Me form on my website, www.loisstrachan.com. That's Lois Strachan, LOISSTRACHAN.com. And sign up for a 30-minute discovery call so we can chat to see if I am the right person to help you to achieve your goals. Contact me now for that free 30-minute discovery call on loisstrachan.com. I'd love to have the opportunity of helping you to achieve your goals.
Thank you for listening to A Different Way of Seeing. We'd love to connect with you. So find Lois at loisstrachan.com or Facebook, Lois Strachan Speaker. This podcast was edited by Craig Strachan using Hindenburg Pro. Hindenburg, it's all about the story. The credits are done at Naledi Media. Naledi Media, all your vocal needs under one roof. Read by Charlie Kasi. That's it for now. Thank you for joining us and see you next time when we bring you into the world of seeing differently.